KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19. Live from the Jefferson County Courthouse, this is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
Hope everyone's doing well. Fall is definitely here. So I guess I'll welcome the listeners from KPTZ. We're a minute early, hopefully that you're with us. And we're here for our weekly check-in on all things COVID-19 and Jefferson County's response. Dr. Locke, the news is kind of chilling on a nationwide and worldwide stage. How are we doing?
Well, I think well characterizes the situation. And we have long forecast a third wave occurring sometime in the fall. Originally, we projected it would be start in November, December, and continue through March. But it's starting earlier than we even predicted. So we are definitely in a third wave phenomenon. It's actually in the U.S. We are already at a case rate that's higher than the peak we received, the daily peak that we reached in July. So this is the highest ever daily case rate in the U.S. And some have pointed to that and say it has to do with increased testing. And it is true. We are doing increased testing now as compared to March or July, and that's very much a good thing. But it really does not account for this increase. And the simplest proof of that is hospitalization rates are going up as well, and death rates are starting to go back up. But what is really surging is hospitalization rates. In the last month, hospitalization for COVID-19 has increased by 40%. And the pattern now is really in more rural areas rather than urban areas. The urban areas were really hit very hard in March and July, and now less so. So it's places like Utah this weekend announced that they will likely need to go to what are called crisis standard of care. And that's a place we never want to be. That's when we are essentially saying we do not have enough of a resource. We do not have enough ICU beds for everyone who needs an intensive care unit bed. So we have to ration those beds and give them only to the people who are most likely to benefit from them. And we actually never know for sure who's most likely to benefit. So this is in healthcare. Being in this situation is what we always want to avoid, is that kind of medical surge. It's happening in my hometown of Kansas City, Missouri. There are reports that the hospitals are full and they're having to turn ambulances away. And we expect to see that in more and more places. As you mentioned, cases are surging internationally as well. Europe is back to where they were in March. So they are replaying this initial surge after a relatively quiet summer. The only real good news in all of this is that death rates relative to cases are substantially lower than they were certainly in March and even in July. And that reflects two major trends. One is younger people are accounting for more of the infections, and they, of course, have less of a risk of death or serious complications. But also the treatment is really getting better. So the survival rate, the survival if you need to be on a ventilator, the ability to prevent people who are seriously ill from even needing a ventilator, all of those things have improved. And to me, it underscores the importance of this medical surge issue, because we have to preserve that ability to have this life-saving treatments available for those who are severely ill. And that's why that's one of the central fallacies of this, what's become popular, this kind of herd immunity notion that you just protect the vulnerable and let everyone else do what they want. it's impossible, first of all, to protect the vulnerable in that situation. But if we stop doing what we're doing now to control transmission, the medical surge all by itself would be unmanageable. You know, that same issue we faced back in March. Fortunately, here in Washington State, we're nowhere near our capacity medical surge wise, but we do have another problem, and that is hospitals are not empty waiting for people who might need COVID-19 treatment. They're in fact very full, still trying to catch up with the deferred elective surgeries and other conditions that they were not able to do when they were more restricted. Plus, hospitals are always about 60 to 70% full just dealing with heart attacks and cancer patients and broken hips and those kind of things. So we're not foreseeing a critical a crisis standard of care problem in Washington State anytime in the near future, we may get back into a situation where not all elective surgeries can be done, and there is a prioritization kind of system for hospitalization. And hospitalization for COVID-19 has been going up. It's increased by about 20% over the last month in Washington State for COVID-19. So here in Jefferson County, our cases are rising. We're up to 86 is our new total. So we added 5 cases in this last week. I'm sorry, I don't have the case per 100,000 calculation. That will come out later today. It was at around 22 cases per 100,000. And by my rough calculation, it will go up a bit. Not dramatically, but it will increase. In Clallam County, some good news, their rates have actually been staying down. So they're at 22 per 100,000. And both Clallam and Jefferson have relatively low percent positive tests. So of the tests done, 1.6% are positive in Clallam County. In Jefferson County, we've been consistently below 1%. And we now publish those results, not just our total for the last 8 months, but also week by week. We're listing our positives per week, and they're consistently below 1%.
I was just wondering how the national trends on percent positives were progressing in this third wave right now.
They're especially in the hard hit areas, they're going way up. There are areas where percent positive are in the 20% range, and many areas where it's above 5%. Our goal is to keep it below 2%. That's a measure of good control and also of adequate testing. You want to do you can keep your rates down if you don't do enough tests, but that's the wrong way to do it. In the outbreak areas, it's much higher. Kitsap County is the highest of the three counties. Their rate is 42 per 100,000, and their positivity is at 2.7%. And then one of the KPTZ listeners from South County asked if we would start reporting Mason County, which is their neighbor. And so Mason County actually has higher rates than Mason County. For those who don't know it, has a population of around 67,000 now, so it's a little smaller than Clallam County in terms of population. They report 553 cases total. Their positivity rate currently is 3.6%, and the rate per 100,000, at least on the state website, is 97. Per 100,000. And that leads me to my next update, and that is on the phase 2, phase 3 situation. So Mason County is a phase three county, and as is the case with a number of phase three counties, which were originally given that designation because of their low prevalence, they now have higher prevalence than most of the, or many, I should say, of the phase two counties. So we updated the board last week and the Board of Health, saying we were going to have this meeting statewide to discuss that process. And indeed, Vicki Kirkpatrick and I participated in that. It was a week ago today. And as some have already learned, the gist of it, the state had no announcements as to if or when they were going to unpause the Safe Start program. Essentially, the entire program was frozen at the end of June. And at that point, seven counties had applied for phase three designation, Jefferson County being one of them. And all of those applications were returned a couple weeks later. So as of last week, it's still the governor has paused the system. He has moved all the, what they were calling phase 1.5 counties have now moved up to phase two. So the entire state is at least at phase two. There are 17 counties, mostly the smallest, most rural counties are at phase three, although Island County and Mason County, which are our neighbors, are at phase three. 22 counties are phase two, and the main development has been that a number of the things or variations of the what was allowed under phase three have been moved to phase two. So movie theaters and libraries and swimming pools can open under certain circumstances in phase two counties. And we, given the fact that rates are rising in the state, we're not anticipating any kind of dramatic restarting of that program in Washington. What's more likely is kind of small fine-tuning kinds of things, or possibly a way for counties that can demonstrate that we can do certain activities safely and we have low enough prevalence on a county-by-county basis. You know, that might be a new trend, but we have informally been told that there's unlikely to be any further announcements till after the election. So that's the update on that we have. So really there's no immediate decisions for the Board of Health or the county commissioners to make. And reapplying for phase three is not really an option for Jefferson County at this time. Then I just might add the schools, that continues to go well. So we are actually completing our second month of schools being open for person-to-person education in Jefferson County. We were one of the very earliest to start in the state of Washington. And as a consequence, we have some of the best experience in this. So we've been sharing our protocols with other counties and trying to share the lessons we've learned. It's a lot of work maintaining the system because we have to do a lot of screening of kids our big change last week is we did a new update on that screening protocol that we hope is easier to understand and more efficient and causes fewer sort of false alarms. So we're now allowing students who develop these kind of vague symptoms that last 24 hours just to stay home and wait till their symptoms disappear and they don't need to be tested and they're fine to come back to school, after they're sort of non-specific symptoms go away. So we're really trying to focus a lot more on students or staff who have symptoms that are more severe and more likely to represent COVID infection. But we are bracing for our first case. Sooner or later, we will have cases of COVID in the schools, and we've, you know, we've done a lot of work on preparing ourselves to deal with that. So if no questions about that, I'll move on to our KPTZ questions. As usual, a lot of good ones. Several of them asked about this, what we call contact precaution. So what is the risk of acquiring the infection from contacting surfaces? The first ask, is it really necessary to sanitize everything that you buy at a grocery store? And the answer at this point is clearly no. Those kind of things of, you know, scrubbing down your groceries or putting them outside for 3 days is just not necessary. What we really urge people to focus on is hand hygiene. So it is a very good idea to sanitize or wash your hands when you come back from the grocery store.
Can I follow up? What about books? I know it's kind of creating logistical nightmares for the libraries to not sure how long they're kind of quarantining books and materials when they come in and go out. But is there a guideline for libraries that you could point to?
I am not familiar with those standards. It's hard to believe that the library system does not have something. I would regard that as a very low risk item. You know, they might want to be cautious to the extent of 24 hours, but our original studies where we thought that the virus survived on surfaces for 72 hours or longer, these are now regarded as not representative of what's going on in the real world. That those were in labs where they used very high levels of virus on surface. And if surfaces are contaminated in the real world, it's at very low levels, and the die-off of the virus is probably a lot faster. The half-life is now estimated to be more like 6 hours. So every 6 hours, half of the virus is degrades, and if there's not much there to begin with, things drop off really rapidly. So focusing on your hands is really what I recommend, and that protects you from a lot of things other than COVID. That's how influenza and common cold viruses are spread as well. So that's really where we recommend people doing, focusing their efforts. There was another question sort of looking at, risk factors for hand and touch versus breathing in air. I was unable to find any studies that really quantified that. Although our evidence to date is that hand and touching is a low risk for COVID-19. It is possible if you were to touch a heavily contaminated surface, especially a damp surface, as in a bathroom that had high levels of the virus, and then touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, and actually especially your nose is the highest risk area for COVID-19. You could get the infection that way. But in reality, that appears to be very unusual. That's not where we're seeing clusters coming from. And what we're seeing epidemiologically, the real risk factors are physical distancing, so close proximity to people for extended periods of time, especially in situations like household members or coworkers, public transportation, when people are not using the recommended mitigations, those are at risk. And it's a combination of droplet and airborne or aerosol exposure that we think that the droplets are the main way that the infection is transmitted when people are in close proximity to each other. And there's more and more evidence saying that these super spreader events, where we're seeing one infected person infecting dozens of others, you know, sometimes as many as 50, 60 people, these can only be explained by airborne spread. So aerosols get in the air, they're floating around in an indoor space, and a lot of people get infected. And we're looking at that. This is the real kind of cutting edge of research in COVID-19 transmission prevention now, is to try to better understand super spreader events and how we can detect them and how we can prevent them. There was a question about flu shots, and that said, you know, I've never gotten a flu shot and I'm pretty old. If I'm using a mask and social distancing, not having people in my house, should I be safer than ever from getting the flu? Is it important this year that I get a flu shot? And I, first of all, would agree that if you're doing all those things, you are reducing your risk of COVID-19 significantly, and influenza and common cold virus. So all of those are beneficial. But the way I'd urge people to think about vaccines is they really have a kind of dual benefit. There's a personal benefit in terms of reducing your risk of that disease. And then there's a community benefit where the more people that get a vaccine, the less risk there is of a community outbreak. Because outbreaks are a kind of chain reaction, and the virus has to move person to person in order to stay in circulation in a community. And the more people who are vaccinated, that dampens or prevents that community-wide spread. So that's one of our big arguments this year. In addition to the personal benefit, which, you know, may or may not be significant for a given individual, there's always a community benefit. And we have a lot of vaccine this year. So we're encouraging people, even people who have not gotten vaccinated before, to take advantage of this ample supply of flu vaccine and make this year the year you get a flu vaccine. But we're doing everything possible to make this the mildest flu season on record, because every person who has flu, we have to make sure they don't have COVID-19. So we're going to have to test them for COVID-19. Next question was, there was a report in the newspaper about a woman passing away at Jefferson Healthcare in September. We did look into that. That indeed appeared in an obituary in the Leader. We investigated it, and that report is inaccurate. We have no evidence there have been no deaths from COVID-19 at Jefferson Healthcare. There actually have been no deaths for Jefferson County residents, you know, even out of county, in Seattle hospitals or out-of-state hospitals. Mortality statistics are compiled by county of residents, so we would know about that. So that's a very fortunate thing. We have had some real near misses. We've had some critically ill Jefferson County residents who have had prolonged hospitalizations in the Seattle area, but no deaths. So that report occurred in an obituary, and it was not accurate. It'd be my response to that. There was another question asking if there was a way of finding out which businesses might have received warnings or fines for non-compliance with COVID-19 mandates, and it's we do have a complaint system that's up and running. It's who responds is divided up a bit. Jefferson County Public Health really focuses on food service establishments, and there's some other city and county agencies that have to do with other evaluating complaints. And then the state has a major role with occupational health and And the fact that most of the mandates come from governor's proclamations. Currently, that system is really working to educate and motivate people to comply. And it's working fairly well. We're making steady progress. Compliance is really quite high in Jefferson County, but can always be improved. But that doesn't say that we do not rule out having to get to the phase where when ultimately education and voluntary persuasion fails, we do have the ability to assess fines and even criminal sanctions. So that could occur in the future. And if that does occur, that is public information. That is not confidential. It's not protected. It's akin to a restaurant inspection. You know, if you want to see what the inspection scores for restaurants are, just go on our website. It's all public. And our penalty system would be likewise. Just like the criminal justice system, that's not confidential, you know, unless you're a juvenile. So we'll take that under advisement, that people want to know that information. But right now, we have not assessed any fines or penalties in Jefferson County for these kind of violations. And then a couple more questions, and they deal with testing. The first asks, why is testing so limited? My son in Washington, D.C. was able to walk up to a testing station at a fire department with no questions asked. But in Jefferson County, I need symptoms or direct exposure. And that is actually true, at least through the Jefferson healthcare system. Jefferson healthcare, at our urging, conforms very strictly to the Washington State criteria for testing, where we really do focus on people with symptoms and people with exposure risk. And the reason for that is that the tests are much more accurate in that setting. A positive is much more likely to be a true positive and a negative to be a true negative. And as we get into sort of testing on demand, that is to say, people who are asymptomatic without risk factors, the tests are simply not near as accurate. You have a much higher risk of having false positives and false negatives that are hard to interpret. Nonetheless, those kind of tests are more and more available. As one of the other questions pointed out, Costco has a test that's now available online. It's a saliva test. It costs $130 and takes 2 to 3 days to get the results from it. But it's a very accurate test. It's as accurate as anything else we're doing. And so you can send a specimen into Costco, and they will test it. The big national commercial lab, LabCorp, does a similar thing, although they use a nasal swab. But it's a home kit. You go on their website, and they send the test to you. And these use PCR. This is kind of the gold standard for testing. So they are as accurate as tests can be. But we don't really encourage people who are asymptomatic and have not been exposed from testing. You know, the odds are very low that you'll test positive. And it's very difficult to interpret the results as to whether it's a true positive or not. Testing will become more and more available. And the thing that we're really preparing for is a huge surge in rapid testing. Washington State is now receiving almost 150,000 test kits a week from the federal government. Federal government purchased 150 million test kits that they're distributing to the states. So Washington State's allocation is 2.3 million, which will be delivered. All of it will be delivered by the end of the year. And so we're figuring out how best to use those. And these are rapid tests. Results will be available in about 15 minutes. And where their first wave is being distributed to community health centers and tribal clinics in remote areas and critical access hospitals, of which Jefferson Healthcare is a critical access hospital. I am told they're going to get about 600 tests is going to be their first allocation. And then we're looking for other ways to use them. Jails, prisons, schools, we think it would be very useful. But these tests are not just for people that are curious about their status. They're really for, they're licensed for use in people who have symptoms of COVID-19 and they're in their first 7 days of symptoms. And these rapid tests are not as accurate as the PCR tests we sent to labs. But when they are positive, they're very likely to be a positive, and they're likely to recommend or to indicate someone who is infectious, good enough irregular nasal secretions that we can detect it in a rapid test, and we think that correlates you also have enough that you can spread it to another person. So we'll be using them in that way. And then a final question was just noted the change in the CDC's close contact criteria. Early on, our close contact definition has always been if you're within 6 feet for greater than 15 minutes to someone who has a confirmed COVID-19 infection, that designates you as a close contact. People have interpreted that 15 minutes differently. So some people used a continuous standard, so it had to be 15 minutes all at once. Others used a cumulative standard, where it could be, less than 15 minutes, but it added up to 15. And early in October in Washington State, we decided to use all the same standard in the state. So we've been using the cumulative standard, 15 minutes total over a period of time. And what the CDC said, in effect, is 24 hours should be the limit to that. So it should be 15 minutes within 24 hours. It is a significant change. What we're really pondering is how it affects school contacts. So where, it might be 1 minute, but 15 times during the day, or 30 seconds, 30 times a day, and especially being within that 6 foot radius. So we're really looking at that and seeing if we need to change what we're doing in schools. Because our goal is that kids are not close contacts of each other. So if we get a case in schools, we'd like to be able to exclude other students from being at risk, but we're still looking at that. This one of the consequences may be that we have to quarantine more students if we get a case in school. Sorry for the long list, but that's the KPDZ questions for the week.
Thank you very much, Dr. Locke. Any other questions for Dr. Locke this morning?
I have a couple. Two things. One, does the availability of tests, greater availability of tests, does that imply, is there any way that if we start thinking about the holidays upcoming, that testing could be used in combination with some sort of limiting exposure to risky situations, any way that could allow for family gatherings is one. And then the second question is, with this focus on understanding super spreader events, are there any scenarios that we have a better understanding now? Like where are we seeing the most cases coming from? Is it in that kind of workplace? Is it still the family and friends? So those are my two.
Yes. On the first point, unfortunately, tests are not very good at ruling out infection. That is, excluding it in people who are otherwise well. And that's what you'd really want for a family gathering. They're not useless in that capacity, but they're really of limited value because it's, you know, if the test tests positive, then certainly that gives you important information. That person should not attend a family gathering. But if you test negative, it doesn't mean that you are free from infection or that you might test positive in a day or two. And you know, the White House learned that the hard way and is learning it still, that you have to do these other things as well. So it might be, though, that testing in combination to other risk factor reductions, so distancing or, you know, taking special precautions, restricting your activities for 2 weeks before you attend a family gathering, masking and distancing at the gathering, you know, all of those things add up to reduce risk. But unfortunately, we don't have a simple or a surefire way of reducing risk in those settings, and we're facing the really sad and unfortunate reality that we have to recommend that people, especially people at most risk for complications of this disease, you know, seriously consider, you know, skipping that family gathering this year, or doing it in an alternate way. It may not be possible for us to make it as safe as we would like it to be, and there are very serious concerns that Thanksgiving and Christmas will kick off further outbreaks at a time that we least need them. But more to come on that. People are looking at strategies for trying to make as much possible as can be. And then on the second question, super spreaders, first of all, one thing with super spreaders we're looking at is we're trying to get better at looking backwards in time at super spreader events. So when we find a confirmed case, we ask the question, could they have been at a super spreader event where there are other cases that we don't know about? So we're doing more of that sort of retrospective investigation. And then there is a lot of research on what exactly makes a super spreader, how can we pick them out. But the most effective tool we have for preventing super spreader events is masks. Because we do know that if a super spreader is wearing a mask, they are far less likely, you know, maybe by a factor of 95 to 98%, to not spread, because those highly infectious droplets and aerosols that they are putting out will be trapped by the mask. So we think that is a major beneficial effect of masking, is to prevent super spreader events.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Locke. David, one more. Do you have any questions this morning?
No, I think you covered it. Thanks.
Likewise. Thank you very much, Dr. Locke. With that, we'll turn it over to our Department of Emergency Management Director, Livitz.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mostly routine operations for us in the Emergency Operations Center. I do want to give a special shout out, though, yet again to our community mask makers who are continuing to put together masks through mid-August to mid-October, so just the past 3 months. They've made and distributed almost 3,000, even though they've been going since the very beginning of the pandemic. Continuing at a fairly high rate as we saw schools starting to open up again. We saw an increased demand, especially for child-sized masks, so they continue to step up to the task and continue to put masks out. Even with all that they've done, all the masks for low-income Jefferson County residents that we've gotten through the city, there actually continues to be a demand, especially as folks, you know, lose masks and cycle through them, et cetera. So our mask makers are continuing to pick face masks. We're continuing to distribute them through schools. They remain available at local places like grocery stores, etc. So whether or not you've lost one, whether or not you just need a fresh one, etc., masks are still out there. And especially if you're have been resistant and you decide maybe I might need to finally start wearing one, they remain out there and available. So feel free to pick one of those up. That's mostly the big update for me. I touched a little bit last week on the upcoming winter. I do want to talk about that a little bit more, since that will obviously affect how we're able to continue on with our activities, how we're able to potentially, hopefully, gather with our friends and family throughout the holiday season. We are expecting a La Niña winter coming up. Most of the models are forecasting a moderate La Niña, although there are a couple that are forecasting a stronger La Niña. And so for those who are unaware here in the Pacific Northwest, that means it's likely going to be a little bit wetter and a little bit colder than average. For the month of November, the National Weather Service is forecasting temperatures will be right around average, although we are expecting a slightly higher chance of higher levels of precipitation than normal. And then December, January, and February is when we start to see that La Niña start to have its effects. A slightly above average chance there will be above average levels of precipitation, and then a pretty strong chance we're likely to see colder than average temperatures throughout those 3 months. The models are showing that the La Niña systems may continue through the spring as well. So it's likely that on the whole, our climate is going to be a little bit wetter and colder than we can usually expect. I do need to note, though, that these predictions are for climate. So these are for long-term kind of macro-level trends. It's very likely that we see some storm systems come through, and that's where our real regular impacts are, is when those storm systems come through for, you know, anywhere from a handful of hours to over the course of 72 hours plus. And that's when we see power outages and road closures and things like that. But that also kind of goes in the other direction, where even though it might be colder and wetter than average, we will get breaks in that, hopefully. And, you know, kind of like this weekend where it was pretty brisk, but it was otherwise clear and crisp and actually fairly nice. I'm bringing this up because I really want to encourage folks to use those opportunities to get outside, use those opportunities to maybe have a socially distanced outside gathering when and where you can, because we... like I said, we are in for a potentially wetter and colder winter that may extend into spring. And so I really want folks to, over the course of this winter, take a long-term approach as we're battling COVID-19 and dealing with this you know, the cold and the wet. It's going to be potentially a little bit rough. So be sure to keep an eye on the weather. Really keep an eye on your own mental health. There are resources available. And, you know, they're available on our website. You can call my department directly. We can hook you up with what's appropriate. But we're all feeling a little bit fatigued, and it is a concern of ours. We talk about this a lot. I know it's a discussion point at Public Health, and I know the commissioners have talked about it as well. It might be a little bit rough for us as we go throughout this winter. We're already kind of starved for human contact. We're already exhausted because of COVID-19. So it might be a little bit rough. So I just wanted to report out on what we kind of can expect, and want to really encourage folks to keep an eye on things and take a more long-term approach to their own physical and mental health this winter, especially as we're coming into the holiday season. So I'm really hoping that things work out and we can safely gather and safely socialize, but we're just going to have to continue to be smart about that. And I know how tough that is, but we really want folks to stay diligent if they can. Mr. Morley?
Yeah, thank you, Willie. So with the El Niña, what does that mean? So as you mentioned, we frequently, around Thanksgiving, is when we have our most active storm events that can do power outages and things like that for multiple days. So with El Niña, does that increase the risk or reduce the risk of severe weather events?
Well, as it's going to likely be a little bit wetter, a little bit colder, I would say personally that maybe bumps that risk a little bit up. But the National Weather Service is fairly adamant that they're in the climate prediction business, and it's nigh impossible to predict those kind of individual one-off events. However, I will tell you that with climate change and like what we've seen this summer with wildfires, we can expect those one-off disruptive storm systems to become a little bit more frequent and a little bit more intense. So I would say, again, this is me not as a meteorologist, but as an emergency manager, that we should expect a handful of those. When I couldn't specifically tell you, but it's likely we will have a handful.
Yeah, I mean the things that we experience are high winds. We can, particularly before the trees have fully fallen their leaves, if we get early snows, that can bring down trees on the power line. And then, of course, it's the rain events that can create flooding, especially if there's a Pineapple Express where you get snow in the uplands and then a warming trend combined with rain, that then you get the melting, and then if it happens to coincide with high tide, anyway. So it's sort of wind surge on the water and precipitation. So, yeah. And so I guess a point would be just a reminder to the public that's watching is we've all sort of been focused on this COVID thing. But we are entering storm season, and so do make sure you're stocked up for emergency supplies for a storm and storm outages. So we're entering that time of the year.
I've done my best to try to pause all the other disasters during COVID, but that's unfortunately impossible. So, it is nice in a sense that for most Jefferson County residents, we have past experiences with these kind of storm systems. So this is nothing new to a lot of you, but you're absolutely right, Philip. It is that getting to that time, and although a lot of us are fatigued with COVID-19, we do have these other things to indeed get prepared for. So now's the time to stock up. Now's the time to check batteries and flashlights. Now's the time to start thinking a little bit ahead, both in terms of the direct impacts of the storm, as well as the impacts it's going to have on our way of life during COVID-19.
Yeah. Check your generator and clean your chimney too.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Unless there's a last question, I know we have a hearing posted for 10:30. So, Dr. Locke, Willie, thank you very much for keeping us up to date, and we'll let you guys go. And thank you to the listeners of KPTZ. And we will move on with our regularly scheduled program and go to our hearing regarding the adoption of the 2021-2026 6-year. Transportation Improvement Plan. I think I saw Wendy Clark.
This is KPTZ Fort Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. Recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thank you for listening.